everybody, and welcome to the Nutrition Network. We are here today with Debbie Cotton, who is from Invivo Healthcare, and we're very excited because Invivo have gone through a rebranding and a slight change of emphasis, if I'm not wrong, but an exciting one and something so absolutely relevant and something that's so evolved over these last sort of 10 years or so into something incredibly exciting and something I think that everybody in our network certainly appreciates. So Debbie, welcome. How are you?
Thank you. I'm well, thank you. Thank you for having me today.
So. Good. Well, we're going to do a sort of little bit of an ambling chat today about, well, first of all, about you, and secondly, about Invivo, and then maybe we can get a little bit into the specifics. So first of all, would you like to just give us a sort of potted history about you and how come you've ended up at Invivo?
Sure, absolutely. So I am a naturopath and I trained in Australia, as you can probably hear from my accent. So I trained in nutritional therapy and herbal medicine over there. And I've been practicing for over 16 years now. I'm a little bit of a study addict, but I've also trained in psychotherapy and I have my master's from the Minster Centre here in the UK. Because I was looking for that real holistic approach to health, but you know, there were so many people coming in with so many layers of things going on, and I just wanted to be able to hold that in mind a lot better. And I've been a lecturer, you know, for kind of at least sort of 14 years, basically, with different colleges, especially CNM and other colleges around the UK. And now I'm lucky enough to be the head of clinical education at Invivo Healthcare, and it was mainly a lovely meeting of minds which has kind of enabled me to come there, and they allow me to do all the things I love doing, you know, researching and writing technical papers and educating and having my hand in product development. So I feel very, very lucky to be a part of the team, basically.
Yeah, I mean, so sorry, I'm old friends with Louise Joyce.
Lovely Lou.
Yeah, who's amazing. And she was telling me all about your sort of, at Invivo, about your environmental, so just correct me if I'm ever wrong on this, but your environmental sort of aspirations for the company. Have you got anything to say about that? Do you know, can you talk to that as well?
Sure, absolutely. So I guess, you know, Invivo Healthcare, who we are, we're human microbiome specialists, is really who we are right at the moment. And so one of the things with the microbiota is it's a really important part of the human ecosystem, but it's also a really massive part of our wider ecosystem and how we interact with everything around us. So this is one of the things that from also right down to patients, right all the way up to our business model, we're really looking at an ecosystem approach to health and an ecosystem approach to business. So we are always kind of looking about how we all impact each other. We're really important to, you know, keep very transparent in all our practices. And so basically, you know, what our interest is in is both the inside and the outside around how we can improve not just human health and ecology, but ecology on the wider scale. And that kind of filters down into all our sustainable business practices. So yeah, so Invivo, it's a kind of a wonderful place to be because it's basically working alongside a lot of like-minded people and we're not perfect, but we're working towards being the best we can be in these places to try and help the overall ecosystem. And of course, you know, right down to our patients. That's what we're really important, what's really important to us.
So before we sort of kicked off, we were saying sort of Invivo, I mean, did sort of focus more broadly on testing, but now there's been a sort of, if you like, a focus on this really quite specialised area. So when we say testing the microbiota, is that a sort of, you know, it's quite a wide term, isn't it? So what does it mean when we, you know, obviously microbiota isn't just in the gut, so that's the first thing to say. So would you like to talk a bit about that?
Absolutely. So here in Invivo, we are really lucky to have our own microbiome laboratory, which is in Bristol. So it's UK owned. It's CQC, so it's the same level of accreditation as all NHS laboratories. And it's there that we specialize in quantitative PCR microbiome testing. And from there, we test, you know, the oral microbiome, the gut microbiome, the vaginal microbiome. But what I guess is really important as well is not only do we test, you know, the microbiome, we also test host markers. So we're also looking at what the person is doing in relation to the microbiome, because testing one in isolation doesn't always give us the information that we're looking for, because, you know, microbiomes are so unique and they're so, it can have really different effects. And it's a really intimate relationship with the human and your microbes. And this is where the host markers play a really important role in kind of interpreting how those microbes are impacting you. So
is everything so different? How do you know what the host markers are?
So the host markers, they're proteins that come from the host themselves. So the ones that we tend to measure, say, for in our gut is things like calprotectin, secretory IgA. We measure beta-defensin, which is an antimicrobial peptide, things like FIT, which is occult blood. We're also looking at bile acids. So we're looking at kind of the proteins that come from the human to do with digestion in the case of the GI ecologics. And then with the PCR, with the kind of the microbia measurements, we're looking at then the microbes present. And then when we're interpreting the test, we use both that information together, you know, what's the relationship like between the person and the microbes, to then see, you know, what can we as nutritional therapists or implement to be able to hopefully make that a happier relationship and a more healthful one and a more you know, one that's kind of focused ecologically on preventative medicine, basically.
So talk me through, sorry, Debbie, I've rather sprung this on you, but talk me through a possible kind of like case history or something that springs to mind where you've gone, okay, I've got this patient who? Just you can make up a sort of polyglot of people, or just something you've thought, oh yeah, well actually recently I had, or you know, so that we can get something kind of what do you call a practical kind of application of where this test might come in value, you know, in value to practitioners.
Absolutely. So, you know, really when we're looking at gut health testing, there's different layers in which you, not just gut, we've also got oral and vaginal, but I'll start with the gut testing because it's the most favoured often by many clinicians. So gut health really is so important to our systemic health, isn't it? It's around what we can absorb, it's around what we can excrete, what is us and not us. It's our really main seat of the immune system where a lot of us, you know, comes into contact with the outside world in that, in the internal tubes. So gut health testing really can obviously be very pivotal in if you are working with gut disorders, so such as IBS or IBD or, you know, bloating or disturbances, SIBO, so on and so forth. But equally, many nutritional therapists are also looking at, well, what's the source of the kind of chronic inflammation that maybe my client is presenting with? So that might be an autoimmune disease. It might be, you know, even obesity is known for, you know, coming from that sort of low-grade chronic inflammatory picture. And often we're trying to chase down where is that low-grade chronic inflammation coming from. And sometimes it's coming from the crosstalk between what is our microbiome and what is it doing, but equally how good are our host defenses, like how good is the barrier between us and, you know, the microbes, and how are they interacting? Because if that barrier is in really poor shape, and there's lots of kind of beautiful research articles to kind of, you know, show this picture, we end up with high amounts of bacterial matter, even good bacteria sometimes, not just bad bacteria, but we end up with high amounts of bacterial matter in the system. And that's enough to kind of put your immune system on that low-grade inflammatory defense, which means you've got that chronic low-grade inflammation, which upsets insulin resistance, you know, your metabolism, you know, it leads you, predisposes you to autoimmune diseases, thyroid conditions, so on and so forth. So there are different layers in which you might be and why you might be using the testing. And many of our clinicians are actually often looking for that kind of metabolic endotoxemia picture, or like I said, they're working with gut conditions and they're trying to work out what's the best way forward.
So what might the test kind of in real terms tell you? I mean, how as the practitioner, I mean, obviously you're on hand always to help practitioners.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so it's not that everybody has to become, I mean, winding back a bit, it's just like I think everybody's, practitioners always think there's this sort of impression that they're being a bit stupid if they don't really get it. But actually, it's like you're going to see this test every single day and mm-hmm. practitioners are not. So therefore, yep. until practitioners become really familiar with it, and even then, you know, I mean, I was in practice. I used testing a lot and I always, always rang in and got a second opinion, in effect, of because, you know, the education's there for free, if you like.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, you might have missed something. So it's really important to engage the lab with what you're actually seeing on the test, because you just might have missed something. But, yeah, so you know, of all that data, sometimes it can be very overwhelming of where to start
sure.
and where it, you know, spits out, and then sort of how you actually remedied that. So what's the sort of actionable point
yeah.
besides the knowledge there?
Absolutely. So, you know, one of the things when we created all of our tests is we, with the PCR, the menu of things that we test for, we are really specific for testing things that actually have clinical utility, so that it isn't, hopefully, it's a lot of information, but equally we didn't want to make it an over data dump, because, you know, too much information sometimes means we're over treating, or we just get really confused in the data that's there. So that was one of the things we did take into consideration when creating the panels. The second thing is, when you get the information, we have lots of beautiful resources available, so webinars, to interpretive guides, to how to read guides, to, you know, little kind of hints and tips on patterns that we're looking for in the microbiome that can really, and then we've even got clinical consideration guides, like what do I do about it when these things appear, and obviously, like you said yourself, you know, we're always available for support calls as well. And one of the things I really want to make clear is, we still get confused. You know, the microbiome science is so new, and we just may have a handle on something, and a new wonderful paper comes out, and then we're like, bam, we need to digest that and try and, you know, incorporate that into our clinical practice. And this is what we really hope in vivo is, we want to show you, you know, we're transparent, we're learning, we're being a part of the process, we're updating, and, you know, and that's the thing, is it's microbiome science does move very, very fast at the moment. So please don't feel that, you know, you may go back to a test 6 months that you did 6 months ago and read it with different eyes, because, you know, new research is always becoming available. But what really matters is kind of, how can I use that information in a clinical way? And that's what we're really passionate about, basically, is making sure that we can get good clinical utility about, how do I change someone's diet? How do I change
yeah.
their lifestyle? What sort of supplements, you know, have been shown to impact this bacteria or this host marker? Or what is it telling me about the bigger picture? You know, what is
yeah.
it telling me about their intestinal permeability, about their inflammation, about the place where they live, you know, all of those sort of things. So, yeah, it's always in the context is super, super important. The test alone is only a part of the story.
Yeah, so you've mentioned PCR a few times. Is that
sure.
the famous PCR that everybody's using
yep.
to interpret this coronavirus? And if so, obviously there's been a lot of controversy around the accuracy of the test. I mean, as I understand it, because the cycles are being ramped up, so they're picking up any old genetic material in there. So what's your thinking on the PCR?
So this is wonderful, because, you know, 18 months ago we would have been having this conversation and you would have been going, what's PCR? So
yes.
PCR is polymerase chain reaction. And what it is it's specifically looking for, we have specific probes that look for DNA of that, you know, it's got a kind of link to that specific species. So it's really, really accurate in that it goes for specific species of bacteria or, you know, parasites or whatever it is. Now, the cycles, this is the thing that, you know, people are worried about with COVID. So every laboratory has to make its own sort of guidelines of, where does it cut off for accuracy? And basically with our test, we cut off at 20 cycles. We actually read up to 25 cycles. So we read kind of underneath the cycles as well. And we're always really sure that we have double curves of everything. So we can absolutely guarantee that if it's come up in the cycles, it's there. So, you know, we're not kind of reading to the nth degree where it could be background noise. So, and that's,
Winding back, Debbie.
Yeah.
So for people who just haven't followed, you know, I'm sure most people who are nutrition therapists have followed the cycle sort of story. But, I mean, this is a big controversy, isn't it? Because they're running the PCR at 35 cycles. And also they're using it to diagnose live virus, which is not the test for it, as I understand it. So, well, you know, if you're magnifying it.
It's still one of the best tests for coronavirus. You know, it's very, very hard to test a virus, especially if it's not producing great antibodies. So it just, you know, it is really, really just dependent on those sort of, like many tests.
I think it's dependent on the cycles, isn't it? Because if you're ramping up the cycles, you're going to find that background noise. And that's the big controversy, which is Britain's running at 35 cycles. So you're going to pick up anything. So you know, then it becomes a nonsense. So we've got to sort of have some, in effect, cross-checking, as you're saying, to say, okay, well, this is interesting. How can we verify this as opposed to otherwise, you know, you're looking at everything and, you know, I've heard somebody say it's sort of like, I mean, this isn't very nice, but sort of mincing up a load of ants and a load of beetles in a blender and then trying to distinguish between the two. So it sounds like you're running at the lower cycle threshold, which sounds the thing to do. I mean, from my very little understanding of it.
So there's kind of more checkpoints in place than just the cycles, basically, for accuracy. So the thing is, we always want to see double curves, you know, so that's one of the things we're always looking for. We also run a bacterial control, so to make sure that there's enough DNA in the sample before we even start running through the cycles. We also, you know, we also have kind of lots of internal checks, basically, before we run any of these things. And we also check a lot of our internal scalings on these things too. So there's lots of, you know, if anything, where you could say we're almost too accurate is one of the problems.
No, I don't think so, because actually I think, you know, again, going back to generalised, diagnosing disease from a piece is different for us. You know, I'm saying it's different for us because we're working on symptomology. I mean, we're working as clinicians first and saying, ah, there's some symptoms here. Let's get that checked and tested. Whereas, you know, again, from my understanding of it, you know, it's people who do not have symptoms of coronavirus then test for it and then find that they have fragments of DNA. That's a very different sort of interpretation of what is disease. So, so I think that's interesting, which is, you know, you're also checking for other bacterial, issues rather than just relying on it on, we've picked up fragments of this, so it must be, you must have it. It's you sound like you're double checking that, which I think will give everybody confidence there.
And equally, you know, also down to the clinician, we're also, context is super important. You know, if you're carrying a microbe, of any description, we always want to check the host markers. So how's your calprotectin? How's your immune function? How's the things that, you know, to show how this microbe may be impacting you. And equally, we also want to look to clinical symptoms. A lot of the time, though, with the stool testing, people are not necessarily looking for, and what we're trying to move away from in vivo is naming and shaming bacteria. You know, we're not trying to say that you have this bacteria so it has to be killed and you, we're more looking at that.
Exactly.
Wider ecosystem approach of how can we nurture a microbiome that we know is good for preventative health? How can we nurture a microbiome that we know is going, you know, is good for kind of reducing metabolic syndrome? And that's the sort of thing that we're looking at. It's more a
nurturing
approach.
I think it's got to be that host perspective as well from what you say. That sounds very exciting because, again, you know, and please correct me because I am a lay person when it comes to this, you know, obviously the coronavirus thing, you know, so I understand absolutely to be corrected. But it's interesting. I don't know where I came across it, but there's a recent study on blood basic blood donations, and it was found that something like 20% of the blood has HIV infection apparently in it. So, you know, obviously people have virus or fragments of virus which do not cause disease for whatever reason because of the host position. So let's talk about the host position. You know, how important is that?
So important, you know, because basically, you know, if you think about the host and your immune system, that is kind of what keeps, you know, everything that's not us from being us. So if you, you know, if you want to put it in the terms of COVID, for example, or anything else, you know, any kind of gut parasite or anything that you might come in contact with, it's really about how good are your mucosal barriers? How good are your immune system at the gut wall, at the mouth, at the vagina, you know, all of these kind of possible entry points, because that is really, that barrier is what's going to protect you from, you know, anything fulminating into a full disease. So you might get a really low grade infection, it gets four at the barriers, and then it's off again. So these things, you know, is really, when we're looking at preventative medicine, are so important, you know, for looking at how do we reduce our risks for certain, you know, disease processes, basically.
So practitioners often start with the gut, don't they? you know, are you saying perhaps we should start at the other ends? You know, in other words, we should be much more attentive to the oral and the vaginal kind of ecosystems, because obviously that's point of entry for a lot of stuff into the body. So, or do you think there's relevance to doing both, or where do you start? That's the point. I mean, how do you know to do an oral panel to a gut panel?
Sure.
Or are you starting on symptoms?
Yes, always symptoms. So always symptoms and context, and who, you know, who's the patient that I've just come in, and what's their aims, what do they want to get out of today's session? And, you know, obviously if I'm working with someone with chronic disease or preventatively, and the more information I have about the host, you know, how they are from an immune perspective, but also the microbes they're interacting with, is going to give me more information to put my treatment plan together. With the oral microbiota, you know, obviously the microbes in the mouth are very much linked to kind of local problems. So, you know, tooth decay, gingivitis, periodontitis, so on and so forth. So you may be testing because there are local problems that you're trying to deal with. But actually, from a more systemic perspective, the mouth and the oral microbiota has been so linked now to a lot of autoimmune diseases, cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's is a really big one, frequent miscarriages and infertility issues, because the bacteria can basically, the lipopolysaccharide cell wall can get through the gum so quickly, especially if there's any damage there, and it zips through the system, and it's just another way your body gets an inflammatory load, and those bacteria can translocate and cause issues. One of our advisory board members is a dentist, actually. She's amazing. And she's done lots of research, actually, on COVID. And she's written some great research papers, which are published in journals, on, you know, actually that the point of entry, if you've got disbalanced oral microbiome, if you've got kind of mouth issues, gingivitis, so on and so forth, it really increases your risk of catching COVID, because that's a place, a really important entryway.
Well, that's fascinating. Yes, I mean, we forget that as well. I mean, you know, obviously, in this whole COVID crisis, unfortunately, it's been the people who've been in less good health who've been most susceptible to the whole thing. But I think there is occasion where people say, oh, well, that person was perfectly healthy, apparently, and, you know, and they've still been susceptible. I mean, it happens less often, but it does happen. You know, somebody who's, oh, he was only 32 and then he got the COVID. So are you thinking perhaps that actually there may be these kind of less kind of critical but underlying kind of almost like holes in their wall of immunity?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, there's been a couple of good papers come out on that recently. One we only read yesterday, actually, on kind of looking at the possibility that people that are getting it worse are ones that have metabolic endotoxemia. So they have got those LPS running around the system. They have got the chronic low-grade inflammatory stuff going on. They may not even realize that. You know, sometimes they realize that. And this is where maybe the cardiovascular disease and obesity comes into play, because actually often a cause of that is metabolic endotoxemia. There's like a similar cycle that goes on, and not everyone's going to present with those end point sort of disease processes that we see in practice. But when you start testing, you might start noticing the missing microbes, the low secretory IgA, the upset calprotectin, raised zonulin. You know, you might start picking up on all these things and kind of going, oh, actually, there are issues going on here that we, you know, for preventive medicine that we want to work on.
So correcting the oral microbiome, how do you go about that? I mean, that's a huge question, but, you know, is that too broad, or can you go up onto that?
No, that's fine. So really, it's, you know, first and foremost, I think I would get in trouble if I don't say visit your dentist. So, you know, do see your hygienist, do make sure that everything is in order, that there's no sort of damage in there that actually you're leaving to fester, because obviously any infection, any pocket, any, you know, structural issue that you're not attending to makes a perfect powerhouse for bacterial, you know, infection, basically. So, and then really what you want to attend to is good teeth hygiene throughout the day. Also, you know, dietary-wise, all the things that your dentist already tells you to do, eat less sugar, make sure there's gaps and spacings between meals to allow the microbiome to rebalance itself afterwards. But also what's really important is things like vitamin A and vitamin D, which is important for calcium balance in the mouth. And also, you know, just kind of probiotics, really, for the mouth is really important as well. So things here at In Vivo, we've worked with some partners to develop, you know, an oral probiotic mouthwash, which is good at breaking up biofilms, which really helps to then kind of improve the oral microbiota of the mouth and, you know, and therefore kind of reduce pathogen overgrowth. So
what's that product called, Debbie?
It's called Biome Oral.
Biome?
Yep, Biome, as in biome, but with the bio.me.
Oh, bio,
oral.
Yeah,
oral. And it's a probiotic powder that you just, you know, you mix up as you're cleaning your teeth, and you let it sit on the side as you're cleaning your teeth. And then you either rinse and spit or rinse and swallow, depending on, you know, how good or bad your oral microbiome is. And you know, it's just an easy thing to put into your kind of your routine to again, as another preventative measure of around oral health.
Yeah, it's interesting because there is there, or you will know this, you know, some people are more genetically prone to having, you know, the chat is that either you have good teeth and you have bad gums, or you have bad gums and good teeth. No, is that right? Anyway, that sort of thing, that this runs in families. Do you think that's possible, or do you think that's just old wives' tales?
Well, some of the stuff that does run in families definitely is your oral microbiota. That's going to get passed on really easily from, you know, from mum to baby. But equally, you know, there are different points in development, in pregnancy and also in childhood, where, you know, different insults of whether it be antibiotics or or different mineral deficiencies at certain developmental points can then leave you with very weak enamel for the rest of your life. So there are also those kind of windows of developmental opportunity that does kind of set you up, unfortunately, sometimes for a lifelong sort of being behind the eight ball slightly. And, you know, and then again, it's around being as preventative as possible in that area and really making sure that you're taking care of your mucosal barrier, your immune barrier in your mouth, and also your microbiota in your mouth.
Yeah, no, interesting. I mean, does also your microbiome of your gut in effect influence the mouth, or is it sort of two separate worlds?
No, so one of the beautiful things, and actually slightly interesting and terrifying at the same time, stuff around microbiota, if they talk to each other. So they have this incredible ability through quorum sensing to be able to talk to each other. So what's going on in your mouth is going to be impacting your gut, which is going to be impacting other bacterial niches around your body as well. So, and we don't know enough about that. Like, there's some exploding research into it at the moment. We know some things, but we don't know all things, and that's quite incredible. What we do see, and we can see in sort of a GI ecologics, is, for example, one of the most common oral bacteria is Fusobacterium nucleatum. Now, Fusobacterium nucleatum is really common in the mouth, and it can be good or bad depending who it's playing with. It's what we call a promiscuous bacteria. So it's commensal. It's kind of okay in most cases, but it depends who it decides to biofilm with, who eats it's going to cause an issue or not. Now, in some people in the gut, when we test their gut, we might test their oral, and we obviously always see it in the oral, but it's just going to be different levels and who it's playing with, whether or not it's an issue. But what's interesting is in a lot of people, we can see it in the gut. And in really high levels of Fusobacterium nucleatum in the gut is linked to colon cancer and IBD, and can be actually quite a, you know, a sign that the microbiome is severely out of balance. And, you know, and why has it kind of set up shop basically in a new microbiome? Even though we're swallowing it through the mouth all of the time, we should also be destroying it as it goes through with our stomach acid and whatnot. So there are some beautiful crossovers for sure.
Yes, well, I mean, and that sort of, I don't know why it brings us neatly to the vaginal microbiome, but I mean, you know, again, is it sort of some kind of separate universe? What impact does it have systemically, and how can we, if we know that that is out of sorts, how can we correct it?
Absolutely. Well, you know, just to kind of put into context, vaginal health is probably one of my favorite microbiomes to talk about, because I do think as women or vagina owners, anyone that owns a vagina, it can be a place where we put up with discomfort and we put up with symptoms and we don't talk about them. And often it's, you know, we're looked upon with shame. And what we really hope to do here at InVivo is kind of normalize that vaginas have a microbiome, and that sometimes they get out of balance, and, you know, sometimes that can cause symptoms and discomfort. And we really want to help people to kind of take ownership of that and work in a way with their microbiomes so they feel more comfortable about, you know, what it is to own a vagina. So really with vaginal microbiome testing, there is both the local, a bit like the oral, there's the local impact of what the microbiota does, and that's what many people will present for. So it's that they've got some sort of uncomfortable symptoms, whether it's a discharge, smell, pain, burning, tingling vaginally, or some people are presenting for slightly more systemic issues such as fertility, because there's a lot of links between the vaginal microbiome and actually the uterus microbiome and fertility. So often people are testing for those reasons, and that's what we're looking for is how can then we, once we get a snapshot of the microbiome, how can we alter that in such a way that, again, is either conducive to be, you know, for fertility or for more levels of comfort, basically, in many women.
Well, exactly. I think this is the thing, which is, interestingly, it's sometimes applying tech, i.e. sort of fertility treatments, mm-hmm. making probably the whole thing much worse, as opposed to, mm-hmm. again, which is what we'd all agree with, really, is trying to get back to root causes of the problem. Otherwise, you're never really going to solve the problem despite the tech, you know. So it's important, yeah, to get everything given the best and a fair wind before launching off onto something that might be expensive and might not actually work. In other words, unless your base level is there, it's not going to work anyway. So, yeah, so interesting, especially around the fertility issue. What was I going to say as well? Oh, yeah, you know, again, sort of clinically, I always found that people who had candida, or, you know, thrush, basically, mm-hmm. Iodine was such a big player, mm-hmm. i.e. lack of iodine, and I mean systemically as well. So it's, yep, just like sometimes just by the by, that we're talking about it. I mean, not iodine. I never gave iodine as iodine, actually, but, you know, things like kelp and all this sort of thing.
Yeah,
was really
yeah.
useful in just being one of those things, the final sort of little missing piece that kind of made the difference in that whole story. But anyway, there you go.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody else has found that, but that's what I found in those days. So... You know, finally, I think we said we would have a little chatty poos about what you're thinking. You know, I know everybody sticks to the back of teeth about this, the Corona roller roaster, whatever people are calling it, Corona coaster. But
yep.
Can you talk to, you know, we were talking earlier before we came online about the microbiome and the importance of, in effect, you know, viral infections generally, but
mm-hmm.
you know, how important that is, in effect, in our defences against any virus, but particularly topically coronavirus.
Absolutely. So there was a really quite a great paper that's just been recently released in the BMJ on kind of gut and COVID and looking at sort of those that have been suffering from more long-term symptoms of COVID, that they were having certain classes of bacteria missing. And a lot of those classes of bacteria are ones that are really, really protective to the immune system in our gut. So it's like Bifidobacterium, Eubacterium, I think it was also Rheumococcus species and stuff as well. So what's interesting and what we don't yet know, and hopefully the research will show us a bit more of this, but we can kind of see from sort of the research in the oral microbiome and other places as well, is that, you know, those that are getting the worst symptoms have got these missing microbes. So what we don't know is that the coronavirus infection that's causing those microbes to miss, or was it someone with that pattern before, and this is what enabled, you know, the virus to basically set up in such a way that it became more damaging and a higher viral load and therefore, you know, longer for the immune system to recover from. And this is really interesting, and I think it's cutting edge stuff, and there'll be much more stuff that comes out of this. But we can make some hypotheses that basically if you're missing certain microbes that have got to do with immune balance, and also that you have, you know, genetically a higher, and you've got higher zonulin or other markers of intestinal permeability, maybe bacterial markers of increased intestinal permeability or increased mucosal breakdown, that it increases the risk of both infection but also the side effects, you know, the long-haul COVIDs, as they're calling them now. So, yeah, it's definitely...
Yeah, it's interesting because we were saying before the call, weren't we, saying that actually, you know, you get this kind of story that says, oh, they were this my friend who's perfectly healthy. And I was talking about my friend who I was at university with many moons ago, and she got COVID in April, and she's still suffering now. And we are talking in February of the next year. So she's still suffering now, but actually she's sort of terribly sickly anyway. I mean, I know that sounds awful, but she's quite she's really skinny. She's quite dry looking. You know, she had a problem, I think, with ME, but recovered from that. And, you know, this is obviously, you know, which we might think of as obviously a complex situation and something like ME, but certainly some viral issues possibly in that, you know, the roots
yeah.
of that. So, you know, you've got an onslaught of this, and then, of course, you're back with ME, in effect, actually. So I wonder if this long COVID is, in effect, actually sort of ME.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we've known for years, and it can be any viral infection can quite easily cause post-viral fatigue or post-viral burnout is kind of other terms that's been called in the past. The interesting thing, though, with COVID, it seems to be causing it in higher amounts, and I think that's down to the way that the virus operates and the amount of cytokine release and stuff that it can cause, especially with, you know, with a high viral load. There's been some really interesting research going on as well with MCAS. So, which is mast cell activation syndrome, and that basically, it, again, it's that thing of maybe someone had the predispositions first of their immune system kindling, you know, not quite being 100% right, being a little bit super sensitive to something with a poor mucosal gut barrier, oral barrier, and then you introduce a virus of any description, that can really be the perfect storm for a lot of these chronic fatigue ME sort of presentations. And you know, and it can be a slow recovery time to get the immune system to re-regulate itself again. And the trouble is we're so, you know, each virus is always going to have its own slight different niche in that, but there's also a similarity to a lot of the post-viral infections as well, in that, that's, you know, there is that sort of abnormal cytokine production that's going on, and it just doesn't kind of repair itself, and then, you know, you end up with kind of a lot of mitochondrial problems and so on and so forth because of it.
Yeah, so I mean, just as because we're, you know, unbelievably, we're nearly coming, you know, not quite to the top of the call, but we're sort of getting to that point. So I was just wondering if, you know, just generally, you know, obviously it's a broad question again, but what's your sort of top favourite things for sort of repairing the gut? I mean, you know, sort of repairing the gut. Obviously, everybody's individual. That's why we do what we do, and obviously the testing you do is very individual. But how might you sort of, you know, you've got somebody in front of you. Maybe let's pretend we've got a sort of long, maybe it's a bit too complicated to say a long COVID patient, but you choose the patient and let's just play with what we would do.
Sure. So one of the things we've done here at In Vivo, so we've obviously got the, you know, the microbiome testing arm, but we also have a really large therapeutic arm. And all our supplements are really, really based on interventions around the microbiome and how we can impact the microbiome in multiple ways and ecological ways that kind of have kind of wider reaching effects. So when I am looking at the gut barrier, you know, we want to think about the layers that all kind of come together to basically form the gut barrier. So we've got the epithelial lining, which is the cells, and we've got the, you know, the nice tight gap junction of the cells. And then we've got the immune cells that kind of sit behind it. So they play an important role in all of those needs supporting. And, you know, those needs supporting with kind of your basic nutrients, vitamin A, vitamin D, and this is what vitamin D is kind of one of the most important things with COVID as well and other disease, you know, as preventative. They're really important for that kind of immune and gut barrier, epithelial. Zinc, you know, all of these things play in really important roles in that kind of maintaining that epithelial barrier. But equally, on top of the epithelial barrier, one of the roles of the epithelium is it makes mucus. And this mucus is a constant barrier that moves and changes all the way through mouth to anus, even vagina. And it plays such an important role in being your first sort of presenting before you even hit the epithelial layer or to, you know, everything that goes through, every virus, every microbe, all those sort of things. So your ability to make what's known as mucin, which are kind of the phosphoglycans, which are made by the epithelial barrier, but they kind of sit on top and they kind of give structure to that mucus barrier. And then your epithelial cells are also pumping out lots of immune cells, like immune things like secretory IgA, beta defensins, you know, all of these lysozymes, all these kind of beautiful things to try and keep anything from coming through that mucosal barrier. And often, you know, when we talked about leaky gut, well, when I learned about leaky gut, firstly as a clinician, we were looking at the big story around there's big holes in the epithelial barrier in the cells, you know, that kind of gap junction between the cells. Newest research is showing us actually we can get a type of leaky gut via just having a really thin or problems with our mucosal barrier, so the mucus sitting on top. We don't even have to get to the point yet that the epithelial barrier is broken. You know, both can be happening. But so a lot of my favourite interventions are actually based on the mucus and the mucosal barrier. Here at In Vivo, we've developed a product called Mucin Plus, which is a blend of...
Say that again, Debbie. Sorry, what was that?
Sorry. We've developed a a product called, it's called BioRevive Mucin Plus. And it's a blend of polyphenols, but also prickly pear extract, and an amazing polysaccharide from seaweed called fucoidin, which all have the ability both to help regulate the bacteria that support the mucosal barrier, so what we call the mucosal degrading bacteria, but equally to be able to kind of support the kind of mucus production as well. You know, so that's kind of quite a specialized product because it's looking at that mucosal barrier. So when I'm looking at gut barrier stuff, I might be looking at vitamin A, D, and zinc. So the one product we made for that is called Beta Immune Plus. Or we might be looking at combining that with kind of the more mucus support, which is the Mucin Plus, Or I might come in from the bacteria itself, and we've got a kind of a probiotic, which has been shown to improve the gut junctions as well via regulating your interleukins, and that's a Bifidobacterium and Lactobacillus kind of blend that's been researched in humans around improving gut barrier, but also some beautiful research on reducing depression and anxiety linked to, you know, poor gut barrier. And that one's called BioMe Barrier. So, again, there's my key things would be depending on what level I come in on. I might be coming in on all three. I also might throw in someone really debilitated. I might also use things like medicinal mushrooms, or I might be using colostrum, you know, all of these beautiful things that can also help the immune system in that area as well, as a, you know, depending again with different clients, which kind of route you see as their point of weakness and their point of entry.
Yeah, no, really fascinating stuff. And I think probably, Debbie, we could keep going on this topic, couldn't we? I mean, there's endless things to explore on this whole thing. I mean, you know, and sort of finally, as we sort of, we were talking, weren't we, and saying, look, it's interesting how with this whole COVID thing, in effect, the whole discussion has been around this microbe, this virus, this problem, this, and it's so kind of like old science, in my view, which is like not linking it up to this microbiome of which we are part of. I mean, you know, I think it's Zach Bush, who I'm a fan of his, actually, who says something like, well, we're looking at humans as the apex of kind of this whole sort of microbiome. We shouldn't be the apex of it. We should just be part of it. So, yeah, in effect, we're separating this microbe, you know, it's like, ah, but of course, you know, it, as we've discussed, I mean, it depends on your health. It depends on, you know, it depends on so many different, it's not about some microbe out to get you if you are, you know, obviously, I mean, we can't say that categorically, but it's kind of like, well, you've got to consider all these different things, like your oral microbiome, your underlying health, inflammation, where you live, your socioeconomic condition. It's all part of a bigger story than just being about, oh my goodness, we're defending against some kind of, you know, killer virus that's, you know, like some film, you know, from the 1980s or something. So what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And this is, again, one thing at Invivo we're really passionate about is bringing it back to context and to the ecosystem that we live in. You know, basically we are a reflection of where we are in our environment, what's around us, what's our microbiomes around outside that we're interacting with. Are we interacting with green spaces? Are we interacting with pets? Have we been breastfed? Have we not been breastfed? Are we got good food available to us? We may not. You know, all of the clean water, clean air, you know, these things will play a massive impact on our internal ecosystems and equally our internal ecosystems and how we treat them, you know, preferably not with loads of antibiotics, because actually that makes an impact on our external ecosystem and is going to kill diversity in our external ecosystem as well. So this is really always what we have in mind when, you know, both with the testing and developing therapeutics, but also when we help people to kind of think about them and how to use them clinically. Yeah,
I love that context idea, because I think that's absolutely it. You know, I think in the early days when I was practicing like 20 years ago and using gut testing, you know, the sort of, again, that thing was, oh my God, you've got a, I don't know, blastocystis kind of issue. But actually, probably, you know, we should have looked at it a bit more kind of holistically even then, just sort of looking at the context, as we say, rather than just treating the, you know, blasting it with oregano, whatever we were blasting with in those days.
Blasto is such an amazing example, actually, of how our thinking has changed. Because you're right, Kate. You know, even I learned you've got blasto. We nuke it. We get rid of it. And actually, a lot of the research papers now are saying, hang on, it's highly likely a commensal. It's probably occurring in a more likely, you know, a really healthy subset of the population group. And really, it might be more of a marker of diversity. And yes, it can get pathogenic, but it seems to get pathogenic when there's missing microbes. So again, it's that the context, there's other microbes missing. When it's been exposed to lots of antibiotics in its past, it seems to become more pathogenic. So again, it's all these things about the context. So you might pick up a stool test and go, yep, I can see blasto. Do I treat it? I don't know. Let's have a look. Is there missing microbes? Is there calprotectin being raised? Is there symptoms? Is there, you know, has there been antibiotic used in the past that might have made it become more of an apex predator? You know, so it's all of that that's really super important. And occasionally you do need to kill something. You know, if you've got giardia and it's really painful, you're going to have to get rid of that. Thankfully, we really want to set that in the context of the rest of the microbiome. And sometimes a lot of these kind of what we call pathobionts, they're kind of only pathogenic when they get a chance, can be pushed out, improving your microbiome internally and externally. You don't necessarily need to nuke it. And I think that's a really big shift in our thinking, you know. Like I was saying.
Yeah. Things, and I think it's about being, as you said at the beginning of the call, I mean, you're an education junkie and, you know, obviously inform yourself and all these things. And I think this is the thing. And I think the studies, you know, are useful, of course, and they sort of nowadays it's something that is obviously to keep an eye on, but also about practice and making sure that, you know, you're listening to your practice, which is sometimes things work, you're not quite sure why. That's why it's called practice, I think. So, you know, it's keeping an eye on the papers, what's coming through, but keeping an eye on also what kind of works and you see your patients get better. And it's an art, both an art and a science, I think, practice.
Just not to forget that bit.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, Debbie, how can people get hold of you? How can they look at these exciting products? You know, how can they start a conversation with you?
Oh, absolutely. So I guess first and foremost is coming to our website, invivohealthcare.com. You can email any of us at the clinical education team at support@invivohealthcare.com. And from there, you know, we would highly recommend if you're a practitioner to get a, just make sure you get a practitioner account, because we've got lots and lots of lovely resources. They're all hidden behind a firewall. So as soon as you've got your login to the website, you can absolutely go nuts on our education section, which has got some really great education from, you know, different people that specialize in these areas, on kind of vaginal health, on fertility, on women's health, on gut health, on, you know, there's a lot there. And there's all the kind of the papers and all the technical papers on the supplements and so on and so forth. But absolutely, reach out. We love having conversations. We love talking about this stuff. And really, you know, we are the human microbiome company. So we just want to say we are really human. We're really happy to have conversations. We're really transparent. We'll tell you what we can and can't do. So that's what we're here for. We're not kind of, we're here to kind of hopefully even improve our own practices as well. So, you know, we're interested in people.
I think that's exactly it, which is, again, coming back to our lovely word that we've used quite a lot, is context. And sometimes, you know, the context changes or the context shifts, and actually you learn a lot through the practitioners who say something. And I was speaking to a lovely gastroenterologist yesterday. We've got an interview coming up with him. He's called Martin Kaplan, Professor Martin Kaplan, who's at the Royal Free Hospital and also UCL, teaches at UCL. And he's an amazing guy, actually, in that he does use supplements in his practice as a as an actual mainstream gastroenterologist. But he says, you know, the thing is, I learn from my patients, and that is that thing with having that listening ear to get the context and to know how to improve your service and what serves the patient. So, so I think that brings us neatly to say, Debbie, that sounds like In Vivo's middle name. And you know, can't wait to check. I'm going to check the probiotic for the oral health, because I'm one of those people who, despite everything, you know, my mum has really bad gums. I mean, luckily I sort of don't, but I'm always on the guard for that. So I'm going to check that out immediately. So thank you for that tip. Personally. Yeah, so I was really excited to try that out. Because we, you know, as practitioners, we're always practicing ourselves. That's why we do it secretly, isn't it?
We're little guinea pigs, aren't we, really?
We're little guinea pigs in a very sweet way. We eat lots of vitamin C and all those sort of things. Yes. So thank you so much. So that's Debbie from In Vivo Health. And check out the website. And we'll have Debbie back very soon, because I know we just touched the tip of the iceberg there, Debbie. So thanks so much, and go well.
Good night,
everyone.
You too.
Bye.